Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the second episode of the new season of Sukoon. Sukoon is going through a reimagining into a new series brought to you by Nasimco, where we explore the rich history, challenges, and successes of the North American Shia Muslim community. In each episode, we'll sit down with leaders and pioneers who have helped shape our community, contributing to its growth and development over the years. Today, we are honored to have with us someone who has been a pivotal figure in the development of the Shia community in Austin, Texas, a person known for his dedication to community building and his deep involvement in the growth of Islamic centers and organizations. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Brother Abbas Banali. Alaikum, Brother Abbas. It's good to have you.
Alaikum salam. Thank you. It's my honor, and I really appreciate this opportunity.
It's truly a pleasure to have you here. Your work in Austin has been inspirational to so many. For those that don't know, Abbas Bhai currently serves on the Nasimco Board of Directors and leads the organization's The Bleak Portfolio. Could you describe your life a little bit, kind of where you were born, where you went to kind of primary school and secondary school?
Sure, absolutely. So first of all, shout out to, you know, both yourself, Sister Farhana, and Sister Shifa. You guys are doing amazing work. So thank you for this. I was born and raised in Tanzania, East Africa. I was born in a small village called Bukoba. And it's I've been there a couple of times. It's by the Lake Victoria, and it's a very well-known fishing village, basically. So I grew up in Bukoba, and then I went to Mwanza, and then I finally went to high school in Dar es Salaam, International School of Tanganyika. And I studied there, and then I completed, 11th grade, basically, then. And I moved to England. This was 1988. I moved to London, and I went to college there. College, you know, in London is like prep, A-levels, basically. So I did my A-levels in London. And then I did my bachelor's and my master's at Imperial College, which is a part of the University College of London. I studied computer science for my bachelor's, and then I did a master's in software engineering. So I graduated in 1994, and I was working in London, and that's the year I got engaged as well, 1994. So my fiance at the time lived in Austin. So we got married in 1996, and that's when I moved to Austin, to the U.S. rather. So 1996, I moved to Champaign, Urbana, which is a small town in Illinois. And then 1999 is when I moved to Austin, and I've been here since. That was a mouthful, but that pretty much summarizes my journey and how I got to Austin.
Yeah. And how did you get into studying computer science? Like when you were in Dar es Salaam, did you have an interest in it? Or was it just kind of someone told you this is what you should do, this is the future?
That is such an awesome question. So, you know, one of the things I always tell youth when I talk to them is somehow there might be a spark, and you won't know till many years later. So for me, 1988, when I was my last year of high school, I was studying computer class in Tanzania. And this was unheard of because computers were just coming out, and Tanzania obviously had no computers. But our school, it was an international school, so it was meant for expatriates. And so we were very lucky. We got a small computer, an Apple IIe, which at the time was like, you know, it's an amazing thing now that I think about it. But we had one, and so I was glued to it. I didn't understand much about it, but our teacher at the time, Mr. Johnson, and I'm so grateful for him, you know, he was so adventurous and inspired in us this concept of trying to understand things. So I was a B-class student, or C or a B-class student. I wasn't an A-class student, but computers I just loved. And so when I moved to England, I you had to pick three A-level subjects. So I picked computers as one of my A-level subjects. And that's kind of how I got more interested in it. And then finally, eventually, it was actually my uncle, Bayo uncle, Muhammad Rashid, whom I stayed with in London, who basically made the decision for me. This is what you're going to do. So it was partly my passion, but more importantly, guidance from my uncle that got me locked into this career.
Yeah. And were your classmates at IST, were they studious, or were you kind of more of a pioneer in terms of like, hey, I'm going to go do this and I'm going to excel at it?
So I'm still in touch with many of them. We have a WhatsApp group, and so many of them have become so successful that they were all like, they were all pioneers, honestly. A lot of the students that I'm still in touch with, you know, after these 20, 25 years, have become entrepreneurs, you know, on Wall Street and stuff like that. One's a professor, he teaches at McMaster University. So many of them were pioneers. I wasn't one of those, honestly. I was more of a follower than a leader, but there was a few of us that really were interested in computers, and I think we followed our passion. So Mahmoud Jaffer again is another one. He's a good friend of mine. He lives in Vancouver now, and we still stay in touch. But he and I were always there, glued on the computer screen in high school, and sure enough, both of us kind of made it into the computing field. So, but we were definitely followers, but we were also sort of charting our own path in many ways.
Yeah. And when you moved to Champaign and it was in Illinois, was there a community there, like a Shia community, or how did you kind of navigate your faith when you moved to a small town? And what year was that?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. So this was 1994. Champaign-Urbana was, sorry, 1996. I graduated in 94. I worked for 2 years in London, and in 96 I moved to Champaign-Urbana, which is the year we got married. So in many ways, we were new, my wife and I, and you know, we really needed time to kind of understand each other and get our marriage off the ground. So it was a fantastic a place I highly recommend folks who get married to kind of move to a place like Champaign-Urbana. No community whatsoever, Shia community anyway. The student presence was very strong as far as Islam is concerned, Sunni mosque, obviously, on campus. But there were a few Shia families, Iranian families, and then there was one specific Bori family, the Hussein. And now we realize how well known they are in the Bori community and also in the Shia community as well. But we used to basically meet at their house for Ashura and, you know, Dua Kumail and stuff like that. So we really used to, it was a very humble home setting and no real mosque or community or anything like that. When I look back, I think that was, those formative years were so important for us because we were sort of nudged by Murtaza's uncle, you know, Murtaza Hussein, who was a doctor, to sort of do some self-reflection and reading of Quran on our own and understanding on our own. So there were no external influences. Both Sabia and I were sort of learning and kind of guiding each other in this journey of you know, growing in Islam.
Yeah. And I think what made you want to stick with kind of the practice of the faith? Because like when you're in Dar, when you're in Dubai, there's a lot of the external pressures. You have to go to mosque, your parents are right there. But when you're at that young 20s age, you could easily just say, like, no one's gonna know if I don't go for the Waqf. No one's gonna know if I don't, go for Ashura. How did you kind of navigate wanting to do that versus the obligation when you're in a Dar community, when you're in a Dubai community, kind of, or London, I have to do it?
Yeah, again, awesome question. When I look back, I think the 6 years that I spent in London were phenomenal for me in three ways. One, I was part of Stanmore, which, you know, is kind of the birth of the World Federation, if you will. Mullah Asghar was there, and so, you know, he was our role model from a leadership perspective, right? So that's one. He was a phenomenal influence in my life and many others. Second is, you know, I was a madrasa teacher also in London. And I was a controversial madrasa teacher. I got into lots of problems. I'll be very honest. I wasn't an easy person to kind of, I didn't fall, I didn't toe the line. I challenged my students and myself in many ways. And then third, and then I'll connect all these in just a second. But third was, I spent 6 months as part of my internship, as part of my master's, and I moved out of London. I went to a town called Brighton. And in Brighton, I actually joined two classes, which really opened up my eyes to other religions. So one was I joined Bible class. I used to go for Bible class every week. I read the whole Bible, And I started discussing the Bible with other people, right? And
And you
second,
told your parents you joined Bible school, and were they concerned?
I don't think I told them. I don't think I
Okay.
told them. That's a great question. I'll have to ask them. I don't think I told anybody really at the time. But it was like I had the confidence because I knew some basic stuff, and I got a chance to break outside of the mold of what you alluded to earlier, right? Which is the influence of community and sort of blind following, right? I took the opportunity to see. Is this the right path? And if it is not, then what other paths are out there? And the second class that I joined was I joined a sign language class, right? I wanted to understand these ways of thinking and learning. So I joined sign language and I joined Bible study. Nothing to do with Islam per se, right? Core Islam. But they allowed me to really get a better understanding of many of the things that we take for granted, right? Which is our religion and even speaking, so it really opened up my eyes. So to put it all together, when I arrived in the US, right? Because back then everybody wanted to move to the US, right? It was the place to be. Everybody wanted to kind of go to, McDonald's and Home Depot and stuff like that. And arriving at a place where there was no community, Shia community, no center, no families, no Khojas, I was grounded in the fact that I was very comfortable with my beliefs and what I understood as our path, the path, right? Now, it wasn't nuanced with a lot of community pressure and tradition. To me, it was a refined understanding of what I believed in. And it's what allowed me to sort of really pursue at a deeper level, my understanding of faith, outside of the communal pressures.
And what year did you move to Austin? And when you moved to Austin, was there a Shia community there? And even not a Shia community, like halal meat and everything. So, I'm in Houston. I know we had a community from probably like the late 70s, 80s, but was there a masjid or how did that work in Austin?
Yep. So 96, we got married and we moved to Champaign-Urbana. At the time, Sabiha, my wife, was in Austin. So she moved to Champaign. She did her bachelor's here in Austin at UT and she moved to Champaign. So we would come back and forth because her parents lived here. So we would come back and forth to Austin. And every time we visited Austin, there was a community. It was a very student-oriented community. But it had around 10 families who were fixtures in Austin. And so, Muharram and all that was done at people's homes or in sort of a community center. Madrasa was run out of my mother-in-law's house here in Austin. So there was a Shia presence of around 10 families, and half of them were Khoja at the time. There were around five or six Khoja families. And they had just purchased a center in South Austin. It was a house, and so they were meeting together in that house. So when I came here first time, as a married couple, when we came here, we were in the South Center. I think it was 1997 or 98, and it was a very humble setup. They had a tent where they would hold the majlis. Our first speaker, one of our first speakers, was Sheikh Hasnain Rajbali. And it was really amazing. We met in a tent and we kind of had our majlis there. And there were two Sunni communities already established, one on campus and one in the north part of Austin. And there were around two or three halal butcheries and Pakistani restaurants. So I want to say there was maybe around 1,000, maybe 1,500 Muslims in Austin. And our Shia community was around 50 odd people, give or take.
But those 50 people felt that it was time at that point. There was enough support, enough financial backing to purchase that center, which was a house in South Austin.
Correct. Yeah. So I wasn't here at the time, but now when I go back and research, basically what happened was there was a gentleman who came from Qatar who realized that there's a need, and so he was able to get some money from Qatar from one generous donor, and we got funding to purchase the property. We also got a sheikh packaged together. We got money and a sheikh Safdar Razi. was our first chick. And so he came along with the package to kind of kickstart our community here. So we purchased the center. Sheikh Safta became our resident alim, and that's how we grew.
And from that moment in 1998, that location in South Austin, that's a different location from the current center, that's Ayaba.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So Ayaba was established as a 501c3 in 1997, and they purchased that center. And then I moved to Austin in 1999, and we purchased a center. So most of the people at the time lived in the north. So we purchased a center in the north here. I think it was around the year 2000, 1999, 2000, pretty much the time that I moved. And so we purchased this center, and we kind of, it was a church, a beautiful church on like a 4-acre property. So we moved from the house to the church, and we were in transition, and there was a transition committee, and that's pretty much when I got involved. I kind of looked around and I said, we're transitioning here. Let me see if I can get involved in the community and maybe take a position. And so it was around the year 2000 and 2001, I think, pretty much after 9/11, when we were kind of getting a lot of attention, we were in transition, and we wanted to set up a permanent structure and get things moving, which is when I joined and took my first role in the community as the building chair.
And what made you want to get involved in the community? Like, was there not a part of you that said, this sounds like I'm going to have a huge time investment, given that it is slightly smaller than most of these larger, Quechua communities, where in New York or Toronto, you have a massive group of people that'll get involved. I'm assuming all your kids were young at the time, so madrasa maybe was a concern as well.
Yeah, so all of the above, right? So why did I join? Our kids were young. Our oldest Sahar was born in 99, and our second one, Kashif, was born in 2001. So young parents. So that's one. Second, Austin is a very multicultural, multi-ethnic community, right? And we can get into that later because it's very interesting. But we didn't really have a monolith. Like, there wasn't really a Khoja structure. So we were yearning for a Khoja structure, where programs start on time, and we have speakers lined up, and all the Khoja
The
stuff.
Fatiha is set out, it's Mandazi and Chai, like the whole thing.
Exactly, the whole thing, right? The typical Khoja rigmarole. But it wasn't like that. So it was the Pakistanis, Iranians, Lebanese, and a lot of students mixed together. So we were sort of, winging it, if you will, in many ways. So there was a lot of room to grow. And so young kids, ethnic, setup, wasn't really a very Khoja, sort of focused organization. And madrasa was still happening, but it wasn't a formal madrasa environment or structure, right? It was still very much done with the volunteers and stuff like that. So what really got me involved, and this goes to the crux of why I still do what I do when it comes to these Islamic organizations, is I'm a visionary. I really have a keen eye for vision. So that is one of my strengths, right? And now I can go back and I can see that really coming at the forefront, which is like, where are we going? What are we doing? But my passion, more than my leadership strength, my passion is working. I'm a worker bee. I love to work. So I still remember I sent an email, a blasting email, to the executive committee at the time, basically saying, "What the hell are you doing?" And the response I got was, "If you think you can do better, why don't you join and stop criticizing?" So that is what, after approval from my wife, who pretty much my better half, I got the official go ahead. Yes, you can just join the community and do stuff. But I was calling out a lot of problems, and I wasn't really fixing or helping fix any of those. And so I was taken to task, right? You keep saying this, this, this. Why don't you do something? And so that's what got me, to kind of really step up and take the initiative and become. So I started the committee called the BMI, which is Building Maintenance and I forget,
Improvement.
improvements. Yeah. So it was Building Maintenance and Improvements, and that's when we took the church. which had a baptism tub. It had pews, and we renovated
Wow.
everything. We got rid of the baptism tub, we got rid of the pews.
Yeah.
We just cleaned out the hall and laid carpet and put fence, put a sign. All of that was done as part of my tenure. And so I ran that committee for 5 years. And it was very fulfilling. It was very challenging. We had
Yeah.
lots of controversies. It wasn't easy, but alhamdulillah, it was good.
Yeah. Yeah. And on a personal note, I do know your wife to be a Babi, and she is your better half for sure. So, alhamdulillah, you had a great support system right there. But what challenges did you find as you started kind of forming this masjid from the ground up? Because I think some of us around my age kind of don't understand how difficult it is. We take it for granted that we can just walk into a masjid and it's all ready for us. We don't understand that concept of, you want to take out the baptism tub and you have this committee and you have to work with others and you have these disagreements. Did you kind of encounter these challenges?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. One of the things about nonprofits is nobody gets paid, right? So all of our organizations in America, at least, are 501c3s. So they're all nonprofits. So nobody really gets paid, right? Apart from the resident alim, maybe, right? Maybe. And so we bring to the table our egos, all of us, right? And it's those that's a big challenge because everybody. It kind of comes to the table with my way or the highway, right? And I looked at churches and I looked at Jamaat Khanas and I looked at synagogues and they all have this problem, so we're not unique. So we have to sort of navigate within that realm of where everybody's doing this on a voluntary basis. And nobody necessarily kind of sort of, will have their way. We have to come together. So a lot of our challenges were around that, around egos and personal opinions, as opposed to what is for the greater good for the community, right? So my advice to a lot of the youth, like yourself and everybody else who wants to get involved, is understand the structures that we have and then figure out how to operate within those structures. And very importantly is if the structures are full of red tape and bureaucracy, then try work and remove those so that we can progress as a community, right? So our challenge really was and still continues to this day, I will say, and I don't regret saying this, even if people take me to task, is we don't have a way to measure our progress as a community, right? So we don't really know if we're progressing. And that was our challenge back then. It still is right now, though we've made major improvements. But we don't really we fight so much, we argue so much, and then the progress isn't that much. Sometimes we take one step forward and then two steps back. And that's kind of where a lot of the challenges for a lot of the communities are today, in my opinion.
And do you think egos are a challenge in our communities, not only when we're building masjids or we're trying to improve areas around the community, but just also within personal matters? And you kind of see this ego rear its ugly head in a lot of situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll be very honest with you. And again, I don't care if this goes out, but I want to be very honest, is there's a lot of men in the leadership roles. And men have a tendency to just assume that their power is for granted, right? It cannot be questioned. Kind of like the way they do at home, right? And so they kind of come to the leadership at the community and they're like, yep, I'm the guy and I'm gonna make the rules, and so it's all over. It's all of the above, right? Now the thing is, a lot of the leaders, men and women, have professional qualifications, right? So they have a certain way in which they behave in the professional environment. But for some reason, when they come to the community environment, they kind of forget all of that and they become very unprofessional, and then the ego creeps in, right? Because, oh, you said this and it hurt me and I'm right and you're wrong. And instead of what does the community need? How can we channel our energies for the greater good, for the benefit of the community, and this plagues all organizations, Muslim and non-Muslim. And I think, in my opinion, what I have found is the ones that have managed to be successful at it are the ones that have sort of set up objectives, what we call in professional language, SLO, service level objectives, and have measured their progress against those objectives. And then it doesn't matter if you or I do it. but somebody needs to get us there.
Yeah. So kind of looking at those metrics and seeing how far have we come and where do we want to go as a community? Like it's important to be able to do that. And you're right, I don't see a lot of that.
Yep, absolutely. And I'll take you back to the words of World Federation's founding father, right, Mullah Asghar. I remember this when I was young. Mullah Asghar used to say this, and I love this. It's a beautiful hadith, and I recommend all of our people, young and old, to use this hadith as a guiding post, right? And Mullah said that Imam Ali, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, has this beautiful hadith where he says, every follower of mine should ask himself or herself three questions every morning, right? And he says, ila ayn ji't, ila ayn tadhhab, wa limadha ji't. Where have you come from? Where are you going? And why have you come? Right? It's a phenomenal way to introspect and then lay down a vision for yourself in your career, for yourself within your family, and then for your family within the community, right? Why are we here? What is the purpose that we are here for? And if we don't understand that, then if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there, right? So it's so important to have that like sort of vision and sort of muhasibah, introspection, to ask, are we going in the right path? Do we know where we're going?
And is that what you looked at when you started forming kind of the Ayaba community? You came from Dar, which is such a proper, East African Kojak community. There are certain ways of doing things, there's the language, the food, everything is just set for you. And when with Ayaba, could you describe what it's like? Because, for those who don't know, there's a massive university there, the University of Texas at Austin. So you've got a lot of youth that come in and come to Masjid for the years that they're in class, but it's also a very dynamic and multicultural community, which has its strengths, but also its difficulties when you're trying to form that up. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You've summed it up so well, right? So we have, if you think of our community and break it down into three different dimensions, right? So we have the multi-ethnic dimension, right? So Pakistanis, Khojas, Lebanese, Irani, reverts, right? Our Sheikh Jaafar Mohibullah is a revert, right? So we have that one dimension, which is the multi-ethnic. And then we have the multi-generational dimension, right? So my parents are here. I am here, and two of my children are here, right? So we have this multi-generational dimension as well, right? And then the third dimension, to go back to your question, is we have people that have been here for a long time and may continue to be here, and then we have another bunch of people that are drifters, right? They come in and they go, right? So hypothetically, you might get a very strong individual come in, finds a problem, wants to fix it, goes ahead and fixes it, and then leaves. And so all of a sudden they came in, they did their thing, and then they're gone in this vacuum now, right? So there's no continuity. So constantly our challenge is amongst all those three dimensions, right? The multi-ethnicity, the multi-generational, and then the transitory nature of the people that come to Austin, right? So we've had a lot of Kojak families who have left Austin. Many moved to Orlando. Some moved to Canada. My daughter moved to New York because they miss the Khoja community, right? And we don't have a Khoja community here, right? We have a multi-ethnic community. We have languages, Mercy, Anohwa in different languages. Our timing is all over the map. It sometimes it follows Pakistani time, sometimes it follows Khoja time, sometimes it follows no time, right? And you have to just learn to be tolerant of it, right? You can't have it one way because it appeases one culture, but not all the cultures.
But how do you not get into the mindset of, well, the tolerance that you allow for also allows for kind of slacking off in terms of getting better? Quotas in general, like we have a certain way because we think this is better. To follow a time is better than not following a time. But I've met people who say, what's the problem in being a, half hour late for something? It's not a big deal. And to me, that's such a shock to the system that I don't understand it. How do you navigate all those people? Like on your EC, is it a variety of cultures? Is it just kind of one? Or how do you manage all these different ways of practicing the Shia faith?
Beautiful question. So before we even get on to the sort of the EC, Allah is so generous, so merciful. He blessed us with Sheikh Jaffer, right? Sheikh Jaffer brings no baggage, right? So Sheikh Jaffer, who is a revert African American, previously Christian, right? And he is literally our standard bearer, right, for so many of these issues. So we're very blessed like that, right? We have a community that is sometimes divided in like, for example, what sort of food do we have, do we bring? Do we have to start Jamaat namaz at a certain point, at a certain time? There's one person, or should we wait for 10 people, right? And so all these questions have come about, and really Sheikh Jaffer has been like our arbitrator, right? He kind of brings us back to the core, which is what is the principle, and then how do we apply it? So generally speaking, and I'll get to your EC question in just a second, but generally speaking, he has been very a big advocate of what is known in jurisprudence as urf. What are your local customs, right? So the simplest example I can give you of urf is, let's say Allah's name is written on a piece of paper. So back home in Dar es Salaam, we used to burn it, right? Allah's name is written on a piece of paper, you have to burn it, right? Then we came to England and it was like, okay, you know what? We can't really set fires here. So now we bury it. We dig a hole and we bury it, right? In North America, urf has basically translated into shred it. It's perfectly environmentally acceptable. It destroys that written name of Allah. So, we can practice Islam in the environment that we're in because we have that flexibility of urf, which allows us to adapt to the times, the culture, the congregation, and things like that. So with that in mind, our EC is made up of seven people. Our constitution doesn't necessarily dictate the makeup of the EC. Like, it has to be one Khoja, one Lebanese, two Pakistani, two Iranian. No, there's nothing like that. So we have elections. By and large, we get a good representation in the EC. It has sometimes swayed to a specific ethnicity, and that's caused us problems in the past. But generally, we have a good balance of multi-ethnic, multi-age, and male and female as well. We always try to have at least two females in the EC.
Okay, that's impressive because a lot of communities don't allow for women on the board yet.
Correct, correct. Yeah, so just
Unfortunately, you're part of a ladies' committee, but that's not really. They handle childcare and maybe some food, if I'm being honest.
And again, let's not bash Khojas too much, right? But this is a hangover
Nope.
from our Khoja days, right? So our constitution doesn't say anything about male and female, like ratio-wise, but it totally doesn't prohibit women for running for the EC. And so we do have women in the EC.
Okay, that's really impressive. And as you've gotten involved and traveled throughout North America and gone to different communities, what concerns do you have? Like, have you gone anywhere and said, okay, this is a big red flag? We hear of different issues that communities are having. Have you seen anything where you've been like, okay, this is something someone should tackle?
Yeah, so and that's one of the reasons why I've now kind of extracted myself from IABA, and I've gotten more involved in organizations that are addressing issues across North America, right? So NACIMCO, Mainstay, things like that. I think what I'm seeing is, if I can just sum it up in three categories. One is the sort of the divergence of our youth, right? Where our youth are going, right? Either the center is not attracting them, or the center is repelling them, right? So that and there's two parts there, right? Which is, we're talking about things that are not relevant, or sometimes we're talking about things that are literally kind of putting them off, right? So that's one aspect, right? Is the connectivity of the youth. Second is, I see many centers struggling with the same problems that so many other centers have already solved, right? Like, how do you have set up a madrasa, and what does a constitution look like, and what should the programs be like, and how much should we pay our resident alim, right? We have the same problems rinse and repeat in so many centers, right, where other centers have solved, right? So that's second. And third, and this is to me the most difficult, is what is our short-term and long-term vision, right? What are the challenges we want to solve in 10 years, right? Do we need sports? Do we need a ghusl khana? Do we need things like that, like short term vision? And then long term, what is Islam, specifically Shia Islam, going to be like in North America 50 years from now? What will my grandkids, have to grapple with, and how can I lay the foundation for them? Kind of the way the Khoja pioneers laid the foundation for us Khojas, right? And therefore we are thriving. I think we need to start thinking along those lines for our future generation, and I fear that we're not doing that across the board. And so I worry about that a lot.
And what do you see in 50 years for your grandchildren for the Shia faith in North America? If we stay as is, what do you see as the strengths, and what do you see as we should have solved this 50 years ago?
Yeah, if we maintain status quo, I think we're gonna see a lot of what the Christian faith is seeing right now, right? So church is up the wazoo, differences up the wazoo, things that are not resolved just keep splintering further and further. So that's one, right? And then you have churches that are kind of going away from mainstream, and like trying to just to attract the population, right? So that's one area I see, is if we don't resolve or cement some of these small issues, they will splinter and make us even deeper. So that's one. Second is I feel that what I worry about, if we maintain the status quo, is a religious education will take a back seat in preference to other things, right? So in my mind, it all goes hand in hand, right? Like politics, our involvement in politics, our education system, and I think we focus sometimes so much on cultural things that we're so behind on other things. And I think we need to kind of do an assessment that if we maintain status quo, then we will lose a lot of youth who have potential because we're so focused on the cultural stuff, right? So that's second. Third, what I fear if we maintain status quo is honestly the youth that have the potential to take us into the stratosphere will basically be doing other stuff, and they won't be giving back to the community, right? And so, like, what kept me attached to the community was what was ingrained in me, that we are the leaders of the future, right? Of tomorrow. But we had leaders that inspired us to do that. I don't know if we have leaders that are inspiring the next set of leaders to come in and serve. And so they're going and serving elsewhere. And that's what I fear.
It is definitely something we need to ponder upon. Could you describe your involvement with NSSIMCO and Mainstay and any other organizations whose boards you sit on and the organizations you support? Specifically, how you feel your involvement is pivotal to the larger Shia community, and also on a granular level, how your community in Austin is benefiting from that. I think it's important for us to kind of delve into that because, when youth or the next generation kind of says, I don't want to get involved in this, it seems like a big mess. It seems like a lot of politics and a lot of just meetings. Like, what do you have to kind of say how this involvement has really impacted you and changed you?
Oh yeah. So this is the bane of my existence. This is the question I ask myself almost every day, right? Which is, so I wear a lot of hats. I play a lot of different roles. And the reason I do this, honestly, as Sister Farhana and Sister Shifa, you both know that I think we sell ourselves short. I think all of us have the potential to do so much. We just got to find the avenues where we can participate, right? And there are lots of avenues out there. So for my local community here, Ayaba, I'm the funeral chair. So I do the ghusl, the kafan, and all that, right? And this is the third hat that I'm wearing for Ayaba. First, I was the building chair, and then for 5 years, I was the madrasa principal, and I was the head of the education chair committee. And then I moved on to the funeral committee. So this is like my oh, in the middle, I was also a secretary for a number of years. So this is like my third or fourth iteration at Ayaba. So I managed the ghusl for Ayaba. For NSSIMCO, I joined late last year. Arif Jaxi, president of NSSIMCO, talked to me. I know Arif from way back in Tanzania, and that's another thing, right? As you stay in touch with your former colleagues, you never know, paths will cross. He asked me to kind of step into the role for NSSIMCO and head the Tabligh portfolio. So I've only been doing it for a year now, but I'm sort of head of the Tabligh board for NSSIMCO. Mainstay, I joined about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, when Mainstay were first forming. I joined their board of advisors. They asked me to join, and I accepted. And so I'm on their board of advisors. And so I worked with the executive committee at Mainstay, their board, Sayed Abathar Tajaldeen, Hajalal, and all these people. And so we kind of helped them with their mission. And then I'm also on the board of ITI, Islamic Texts Institute. We publish books with Sheikh Rizwan. So I'm the treasurer, and I'm also a board member there. And I'm also on the board of Enduring Harvest, which is a 501c3 that Dr. Sajjad Zalzala set up in Dearborn. Again, a phenomenal entrepreneur, visionary. So I sit on his board as well. So these are like my official positions, if you will. It takes a lot of time, but I believe that the most important quality, if you do decide to go down this path, is to manage your time well and hold yourselves accountable for what you like. There's a potential to waste a lot of time. And so I can't really, this is not a video thing, but I have papers all over my desk of all the things that I need to get done. And so I'm a very traditional, I take notes, and I have my own to-do list on paper. And that's how I'm able to accomplish a lot of what I'm able to do.
And what pitch would you give the youth for getting involved? What do they have to gain? They're giving up their time. Okay, and you say, come and join the Simcoe, come and join Mainstay. Like, this is the difference you'll make. Can you tell them that they'll actually make a difference? Like, what would you say to a youth in front of you who said, ah, I don't know about giving up my weekends for this?
Oh, absolutely. I have this conversation regularly with my son. I'm trying to encourage him to do stuff, and he's stepping up. But this is the same conversation we have. Like, Dad, why should I? And I'm enjoying playing my sports, and this is a time suck. And what am I going to get out of it, right? So, fantastic question. I would say it boils down to two things. Number one, if you don't feel like you're making any progress, then don't do it, right? You got to set yourself up some milestones and make sure you accomplish from the outset. You're making progress. Number two, there will be hurdles, there will be bottlenecks. Don't let those weigh you down, but reach out to people who can unblock you. This is what we do at work, right? We try and, as leaders, we try and unblock the junior people, right? Because the junior people run into obstacles, so we unblock it. You have to quickly figure out how to navigate and identify the people that can unblock you from the progress you're trying to make. So identify your milestones, start working towards them, and go to the people that can unblock you. If you can't identify your milestones, if you can't find the people that can unblock you, move on to the next organization. There's plenty of organizations out there that would love your talent, your abilities, but be diligent about where you give your time and make sure you're chipping away at something.
And it sounds like volunteering has really made you a huge part of who you are as a person, and that has it probably impacted your role just as a father and all your other relationships in life.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, volunteering I think is pivotal. I think it's the ethos of what institutions, especially Islamic institutions, are built upon. It has challenges, but the rewards, are amazing. Yep,
This was
I remember this quote I read on somebody's fridge, right? It says, "I work for the Father because the rewards are heavenly." And so and I he had this quote on his fridge every morning. He would wake up and he would say, obviously he's referring to Jesus here, right? But I work for the Father because the rewards are heavenly. And so the idea is, it's very challenging here, but just know that for the greater good in the afterlife, which is the essence of our belief, right, is where our rewards lie.
No, this is great. This was a lot to ponder on and think about, and I'm sure our listeners really value it. Just to end on a fun question, when you go back to Dar, what's the number one restaurant you have to go to first?
When I go back to Dar es Salaam, what I call affectionately Bongo, when I go back to Bongo, and we go there often. So many of the restaurants that I grew up with no longer exist, right? So really what I miss more is the taste of certain foods and the whatever restaurant of the day or of the year, right? So I'll give you an example. I miss street food a lot, right? So Madaf, Yama Choma, Mogo, and stuff like that. So wherever the place is that is the in place is where I end up going. And that changes from year to year. So last year when we went, it was Natasha's chicken is the nyama.
Chicken,
So we'd go for that. Then Oyster Bay for street food.
Classic. Yeah. Do you still eat the nundu or do you get sick?
Nundu, I try to avoid for health reasons. I'll have a
Wise.
bite. Sabia, my wife, and I will maybe share a couple of sticks. You have to have it.
Yeah.
I mean, part of our DNA.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Abbas, I thank you so much for sharing your journey with us. Your dedication to the community and your insightful reflections give us so much hope for the future. You've set an example that many of us can learn from. To our viewers, we hope this conversation has provided you with a deeper understanding of the roots of our community here in North America and the hard work that goes into building and sustaining it. At NACIMCO, we are committed to celebrating leaders like Abbas Bandali and fostering connections that strengthen our community for generations to come. We invite you to continue this journey with us as we bring you more inspiring stories from across the continent. Thank you for listening, and until next time, Salaam Alaikum.